Welcome to ASME TechCast, bringing you the innovators, innovations, and the issues that push the envelope of engineering. Hello, this is Jeffrey Winters, Editor-in-Chief at Mechanical Engineering Magazine. Today, we are talking about energy efficiency regulations, specifically New York City's Local Law 97, which is intended to reduce the climate impact of the largest buildings in the largest city in America. Joining me to talk about this today is Tristan Schwartzman, Principal and Director of Energy Services at Goldman Copeland, an engineering services firm in New York City. Tristan, welcome to the big show.
Thank you.
Now, if you don't live in New York City, and you know, granted, most people don't, let me say that this topic is important for everyone. Local Law 97 is an attempt to control and reduce the carbon emissions from large commercial and residential buildings, which are some of the most difficult to abate sources of greenhouse gases. I mean, car owners can expect to get a new car once a decade, and utilities are retiring 40 and 50-year-old coal plants without too many problems. But large buildings are expected to last for generations. And the systems that are built into them are difficult to change. In many localities, regulations are looking to tighten requirements on new buildings, but Local Law 97 aims to push owners of existing buildings, especially those that are more than, I think it's like 50,000 square feet. I forget what the, I mean, Tristan will know this. Tristan will know this. The largest buildings install more efficient mechanical systems and lighting, and eventually replace gas heating and cooking appliances with electric ones. It's a big topic, and so let's dig in. So, first of all, Tristan, New York City is a fairly energy efficient place to begin with. People can walk or ride transit, and instead of drive, and they live in multi-story buildings that are somewhat easier to keep warm than your stick-built suburban ranch houses. So why is it important for the owners of large buildings to upgrade in the ways that Local Law 97 sets out?
Okay, so there's a couple of reasons. First, just is the dramatic size of the buildings mean that it's a great place where you can have a huge impact. So if you cut the energy of an 800,000 square foot building, it's going to make a lot more difference than if you cut the energy of a 2,500 square foot house. Second, a lot of these buildings are very old and have relatively inefficient systems. So the impact that you can have can be very dramatic. You can see heating loads cut in half across these large buildings. And then kind of the third thing that comes into play is you look at buildings, the carbon impact of putting up a new building is massive. So if you can find pathways to green existing building stock without too much cost, it can be a really great way to keep a lot of people having the heating and cooling and electric that they need while minimizing the impact.
Right. So, I mean, basically, if you tore down a leaky old building to build up a really tight and efficient new building, that might be great in terms of the energy efficiency going forward, but you're expending this huge amount of energy and carbon emissions from both the machinery and the concrete to make that new building. Whereas all that stuff is already spent building, you know, in a building like mine where I live. And so, you know, if we can tighten up the energy efficiency in a building that already exists, we're not spending the capital or the carbon capital, and we're getting the rewards anyway.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And just because I flubbed this, and so people at home should know this. It's not all buildings. It's like what's the upper or what's the lower threshold for buildings that fall under Local Law 97?
Yeah. So the Local Law 97 applies to all buildings over 25,000 square feet.
25,000
square feet. So it's a large chunk.
Yeah, so that's, you know, that for someone who doesn't have a good sense of what 25,000 square feet would be, that would be basically like a 10-story building, you know, on a sort of a you know, a quarter block. I mean, what would that, what describe what a 25,000 square foot building would be like?
Well, so if you've been in any big city, there's a lot of these kind of 6-story clunky buildings wandering around.
Yeah.
Multifamily. Those 6-story clunky multifamilies tend to bust the 25,000 square foot cap.
Okay.
So your standard brownstone with 3 or 4 stories, maybe 2 or 3 residents, that doesn't get you there. Okay. But beyond that, you start to see 25,000 square feet.
Okay, very good. Now, if I understand the law correctly, and I'm not a lawyer, but the regulations require certain levels of efficiency, you know, immediately, and then higher levels as certain milestones in the future. I think like 2030 might be the next one. So what sort of changes are building owners looking to do right now in order to meet these near-term goals? And then what will they have to do to tighten the standards in, you know, in the 2030s? And I guess the idea is to get down to zero net carbon by 2050 or something like that. And mm-hmm. Is there a single sort of favorite go-to change that buildings are making, or, you know, are there different approaches depending on the state that the building is in? You know, the kinds of things that are going on in the building.
Yeah. So there's two answers to this question. There's one for 2025 and there's one for 2030. Because the context changes significantly. 2025, the initial target was kind of based on about 20% of New York City buildings failing to meet the goal, as in most of them are fine. So of these buildings that don't meet the goal, it's usually because of maintenance that hasn't been done, old and inefficient systems. And so these buildings have usually low cost opportunities to meet the target. They can get there. There are a few exceptions. There's particular building types. Hospitals may have trouble. Museums may have trouble. Buildings with a heavy data center load may have trouble. And these are kind of holes in the law that we're all trying to find ways to button up. But most buildings can meet the 2025 target just by doing practical 3 to 5 year payback sorts of measures. Moving towards 2030, the picture changes a great deal because that target is based on, I think, about 25% of buildings would comply without making any change. So most buildings won't. As they move towards 2030, the city has issued rulings where carbon coefficients for electric become much more generous to the building owner, while carbon coefficients for natural gas and fuel oil stay very strict. They're trying to push city buildings towards electrification. So, moving toward that 2030 goal, there is a path to really tuning up and making sure everything is very tight and getting there that could potentially work for most buildings and is the avenue that I'm pushing my clients to and towards in terms of 2 to 3 year action plans. Okay. But they also need to be looking at ways to gradually phase away from steam, fuel oil, gas, heat, and toward all electric solutions. I personally am not encouraging my clients to spring into action. I find the technology is much better year on year. So I'm looking at electrification enablization, that sort of thing. I'm looking at tuning steam system buildings to use as little as they possibly can so that we have a good understanding of how much heat they're going to need, as opposed to how much is being lost by 100 years of deferred maintenance in some cases. Maybe the building you live in?
No. We're actually quite good.
Okay. So then that electrification enabling is something that's then going to turn into, as you move into that 2030 to 2035 and beyond cycle. I do see the steam radiators gradually and thankfully becoming a thing of the past.
Well, that's something that I'm going to go add a question here, because this is really interesting to me, because we're a steam heat building, and we have a dual fuel boiler that runs mostly gas. But from what it sounds like, in order to meet these ever stricter requirements, buildings like mine that have been using steam radiators for a long, long time are going to have to abandon that and go to, maybe in window heat pumps or some other electric source of heat. Is that what you're thinking is going to be necessary for meeting the requirements in the 2030s?
Yeah, I believe that. unless something changes.
Yeah.
To meet your 2035 requirements, I think you'll be able to get by with 2030 if you tune the building up and it's using as little as it can. Maybe for a residential, you're targeting around 20 kBTU per square foot of heat. But by 2035, you're going to have to look at something to move that toward an electric heating system. And I'm not encouraging anyone to buy today's products necessarily to do that, unless you're due for some upgrades anyway, to offset the costs, if you got to spend $5 million anyhow. But I think there's a big question now about, are people going to be able to put in new risers so that you can continue to have a centralized system, which is going to be much more efficient? Water source heat pumps with waste heat recovery are much more efficient than those in-room solutions,
right?
Or now, at least. So, that's a costly thing, but it is a really efficient thing, and it may be where buildings like yours end up in this 15 to 20 year window.
So, if your boiler is nearing the end of its normal life cycle, it's the kind of thing that buildings are going to need to look at and say, well, we probably don't want to go with another, fossil fuel boiler. We're going to want to invest in some sort of a new system that's going to last us, through the threshold of these, 20, 30, 20, 35 and forward, regulations.
Yes.
Yeah.
The short answer is yes.
Yeah. well, that's good to know. I'll bring that to the next co-op board meeting. As most of, just to remind some of our listeners in podcast land, the six-story 80-some unit building I live in was built in the 1920s. And like I said, we're in good shape for now. But we, in addition to the whole deal with the steam heat, we're looking at adding solar panels to the roof when we need to replace the roof, some other stuff like that. But we're looking at this fairly positively, and we're kind of like aiming ahead at some of these changes. But I know there's been some pushback from some of the owners of the largest buildings in the city about this law, and they're looking to either soften or roll back the law. In your work at Golden Copeland, are most of the building owners that you're dealing with making plans to meet this stuff, or are they looking for loopholes or lobbying for exceptions? Or you mentioned museums. I mean, the Metropolitan Museum, they're this huge old building. I mean, they're probably going to lobby for an exception, right? I mean, you know, mm-hmm. what's the general attitude out there for building owners?
So when I talk about Local Law 97, what I believe is that one of the real positive things about it is it did push the industry toward a more value-based representation of energy savings. And so where buildings before may have been investing in good ideas and just assuming the calculations were all true and everything worked out, now people are really looking at the actual energy they use and looking at ways to drop that energy. I think all the bigger players, the people with the financial resources to look at it, are actively trying to reduce their load. Now, simultaneously, they're also trying to push back against the law, but they should be. That's their job. They have shareholders that they're accountable to. And a lot of the things that you would have to do to electrify these buildings aren't necessarily very practical, and aren't necessarily things that they can economically do in a 5-year window. Right. So their pushback is warranted. And so I think kind of you have a law that is ambitious and is pushing the dialogue in the right direction. And you have pushback against that law that is fair and appropriate.
Yeah, and I think there was a recent, at least a trial balloon floated by the administration in the city, the Eric Adams administration, where they were thinking about perhaps putting a 2-year pause on the law to let building owners catch up. Is that right?
Well, so the most recent proposed ruling that they issued allows buildings to apply for a 2-year exemption if they prove, I'm losing the word, but fair, demonstrated good faith effort.
Okay.
Right. So that's actually a ruling that's been proposed. That doesn't mean that it's going to go through, but it is official. And I'm in favor of that. I mean, it gives people kind of a chance to make excuses and not do the work, but it also gives people a chance to continue to gradually get there. And when you look at the quantity of 25,000 square foot plus buildings,
yeah,
there's a lot of work to be done.
Yeah, and it's not rolling back the law in its entirety. It's just basically saying, well, we understand that there's this is a lot of work, probably more work than was originally anticipated when the law was passed in, I think it was 2019. And I guess, also since 2019, a lot of the commercial building owners have seen declines in rents because people like me are working from home. So it's it sounds as if there's probably some justification to slow it, but not necessarily eliminate these sort of regulations.
That's my opinion exactly.
Okay. And I promised our listeners outside of New York, we would explain why this is an important story for them. So what can other cities and towns learn from the New York experience that will help them cope with the changes that are coming down the pipe in the coming decades? Or what if, you're like, everybody else in my family who lives in a suburban house, single family house, what's important for them?
Okay. Well, I'm going to dodge the suburban house for a minute because that's a tougher sell.
You're a smart man. I like dodging suburban houses too, if I can get away with it.
But I think that these sorts of laws in different parts of the country, they're coming into place and people are taking different avenues, but it's happening everywhere. And it's going to happen everywhere. These laws are going to come through. So seeing how the local market here reacts and makes changes should be informing long-term capital planning of someone who owns a 150,000 square foot building somewhere else, okay, or is a co-op member of one, or a 50,000 square foot building. The second big piece of it is, as we look through it, the state is funding a lot of pilot programs, some of which are going to be terrible, some of which are going to be medium, and some of which are going to be great. And so we do become kind of a guinea pig that you can keep an eye on and learn from. And so, you know, we might develop a really nice rooftop unit solution that's going to be much more efficient and could apply to every 100,000 square foot multifamily residential built in the last 25 years. We're trying, actually. Yeah.
Spoiler alert.
Okay. So, you know, I think there's going to be a lot of solutions that come out of it that may be applicable anywhere, and will be easier to implement for the second and third and fourth tier of cities that go through this sort of thing. And then the last piece is just the technology itself. The people out there selling equipment, they respond to a market as big as New York City and the other cities that are doing similar programs. And so even a single family home in the suburbs is going to have a better heat pump available to use and newer, better technology that may not have made it to the US market. Maybe Europe tends to be pretty far ahead on the heat pumps, but there's new things coming into the market as a result of this that I think are going to be applicable even in those single family homes.
So it's not just that New York City is, you know, becoming more efficient, but we're sort of making a market for efficiency appliances, you know, and technologies that can be then used in everywhere else in America.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. There you go. So one last thing before I let you go, because I never know the questions that I should be asking it in. What's the single most important thing? What's the single most important takeaway that you'd like our listeners in podcast land to remember about this topic?
All right. For me, if you take building energy efficiency as something that matters, I think the key finding as we go from targeted energy measures to an overall building energy performance analysis is that the energy consumption of buildings varies incredibly widely depending on how well that building is maintained and how well that building is operated. You can have the exact same building right here and right here and right here, and one of them can use 15 kbtu to heat itself, one can use 30, and one can use 60. And as you start to see benchmarking numbers, you actually see that that's really happening. And that building that uses 60 could just use 15 without spending hardly any money at all. So the key takeaway from 97 is making sure your building is running exactly the way it should be will save you a huge amount of money.
Well, saving money, everybody loves that. We have to leave it there. Tristan Schwartzman of the engineering firm Goldman Copeland, thank you for joining us today. This is great. I learned something. I'm going to go take it to the co-op board meeting next month. So. And to all of you out in podcast land, thank you for listening. And be sure to subscribe to ASME TechCast on Spotify, iTunes, SoundCloud, and whatever other podcast platform you prefer. Until next time, this is Jeffrey Winters. Have a great rest of your day.